You're very welcome to the Alison Spittle Show. I'm Alison Spittle. Thank you so much for choosing this podcast. This week's guest is Adam Hills, and he was amazing. I got on with him so well, and I had a great time, although we didn't get off to a good start because I interviewed him in the Tree Arena. He was very good to take some time out before the Tree Arena gig for Comic Relief on St. Patrick's Day. And I had a little dressing room all set up to do this interview in with all of my recording equipment, but I forgot to bring my microphones, and I was mortified. I was there with two microphone holders, a recorder, and nothing else. So my lovely partner Simon sent up the microphones in a taxi, and we were about 20 minutes late. So we really got into it at the start, and there was no like formal start. It was just, we set it up, pressed record, and then tried to get as much time as possible. And Adam couldn't have been nicer. Like, genuinely, it was so nice. He was so nice. He never made me feel in any way like I was inconveniencing him, even though I definitely was, because we had to start about 15 minutes later. Anyway, look, I am really happy with the interview otherwise, and I shouldn't be telling you what mistakes I'm doing. It was supposed to be like a little funny anecdote, but now I'm looking back with regret, which is most of my anecdotes, actually. Like, if you think about it a bit more than the surface, actually quite sad. So anyway, have a listen to this, and thank you so much to Copperberg, who are our sponsors this week. I've had them before, and I'm very happy to have them again. Quite a lovely fruity alcohol cider drink that I actually drink myself. So yeah, very happy to have them on board. And yeah, I'll chat to you soon.
Even come in just for the night. I said, well, I could, but it would mean landing from Australia that morning and then flying out straight after the gig.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he went, well, then do it. It'll be a great story.
Oh, my gosh.
And the only way I could convince the TV producers to let me do it was that if I did some backstage interviews for the TV show whilst I was there. So flew from Australia to London, landed at 6 a.m.
Yeah.
Went to the hotel, had a few hours sleep, went to the O2. Filmed interviews with Alan Carr and Jonathan Ross, went on stage for 4 minutes, walked off stage onto the back of a motorbike that was then driven to the airport, and I was on the 11 p.m. flight back to Australia.
So you spent less than 24 hours in...
Yeah.
No way! Oh, my gosh. That's...
So it's 17 hours I was in London for.
That's crazy. That's crazy. What did you watch on the plane on the way? I feel like the journey is half the fun.
I think I slept the entire way.
Yeah, you would, actually. Sorry. I was expecting you to be watching 6 hours of television.
To the point where when I got back on the plane in Dubai, I had the same crew that had taken me to Dubai that morning.
Right. Oh, my gosh.
They'd had like a day in Dubai. And then suddenly I get on the plane again, and the guy looked at me and went, did they not let you into the country? I was like, no, I went and... did a 4 minute spot.
You were technically like smuggling comedians' interviews. That's what you did.
Yeah, I probably wasn't supposed to do backstage interviews, so technically it was.
Was this the, because I was looking up on your Wikipedia, is this Spicks and Specks, or what show was this in Australia? How did you pronounce it?
Spicks and Specks was the name of the show.
Thank God.
It was the name of a Bee Gees song.
Right.
And it was like the bits and the pieces of Girls on My Mind. It's like a memory of where are the girls that
Okay.
I don't know. I remember throughout my life. It was the Spicks and the Specks of the Girls on My Mind. And because it was a music quiz show, I guess they thought it's about the Spicks and Specks of music trivia that hang around in the back of your brain.
Right,
and
okay.
It was the first ever Bee Gees number one in Australia.
Right.
So there were all these reasons for calling it that.
Yeah.
But Joan Rivers came out to Australia to present an award at our big TV awards.
Yeah.
And Joan Rivers... can I swear? Am I allowed to swear?
Yeah, you can swear. Great. Go for it.
Joan Rivers walks on stage, as you would imagine, and goes, it's great to be here in Australia. I don't know who the fuck you people are. Live on air. The room's, you know, falling apart. And then someone tried to, are you happy being here at the award? Really? I have no fucking idea where I am.
Oh my God.
She went, okay, let's read out the nominees. And she got to Spicks and Specks, and she went, oh, I can't say that.
Oh my gosh.
And then they had to convince her, no, it's fine, you're allowed to say.
That's nice that there's a line for Joan Rivers, and that was it. My gosh.
And apparently, you know, dropping the F-bomb twice on live television is not the line.
No, but
going a bit further was. No, so after Spicks and Specks, I then hosted a talk show called Adam Hills Tonight.
Okay.
So I did that for a few years, and then the last.
And was that like a straight kind of talk show? Was it kind of like you as the front man? And was there any kind of, did you kind of add anything to that show? I haven't seen the show, but like,
I always
figure if I get a chat show, I would like do crazy stuff with it. Like, what did you?
Here's how I knew I was. Completely unprepared for what I was doing was when I was asked, so is it a chat show or a talk show?
What's the difference?
I don't know. I still don't know. Or a tonight show. That's what it was. Is it a chat show, a talk show, or a tonight show?
And
I
went,
it's a bit of all of them, to be. I don't know.
Yeah.
I honestly don't know the difference. And the main thing was the difference between a talk show and a tonight show.
Mm.
And I still don't really know the difference. I'm not entirely sure.
No, I'm trying to think of, you've done a Late Late Show, have you, in Ireland?
Yeah.
I mean, what would we describe that as?
I don't know.
Because I think that's an institution in itself that I went on it last year, and I was so afraid that you could follow someone that has a horrible disease, and as a comedian, that's not a good run-up or anything like that. So did you have anything like that on your show or
No,
Milking
I
House?
Remember doing the Late Late.
Yeah.
And I can't remember whether I'd sent in word for word what I was going to say, but I basically said, look, I was going to talk about my prosthetic foot.
Yeah, yeah.
And there is a line about someone asking if you could have sex whilst having a prosthetic foot and being taken aback by that.
Yeah.
And then it moved on to someone asking me, have you ever used it to have sex?
And what? Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And then my joke being, you know, at what point while in the throes of passion.
Yeah.
And, you know, my partner says, what do you want to do next? Should I go, I want to wear you like a slipper. Now, it was as I approached that line on the Late Late Show that I thought, I probably shouldn't be saying this right now, but I'd started the story.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And off to the side of the camera, I saw my manager just suddenly grit her teeth. And I thought, I can't not tell the story now. I just have to tell the story. So I just told it.
You told it. And there wasn't any protest or anything like that?
No, I think it was, if I remember correctly, I think it was Gay Byrne.
No.
I think it was back
then. You were the OG.
Yeah. And I mean, it certainly it brought the room to,
I'd
to
say
a strange point.
I'd say so.
But it's one of those weird things of, I mean, technically I didn't swear.
No.
You didn't say
anything really that explicit.
No.
It is like to say, I'll wear you like a slipper, sounds like something out of an Enid Blyton novel, doesn't it? You know? Just quite nice.
Which was always why I like the line. It's the most innocent sounding slipper. It was one of those comedy words where you're writing a joke.
Yeah.
And I did try it with sock.
I think sock is worse because there's sexual undertones of socks.
It's too, even the word itself sounds a bit harsh.
It sounds like...
Yes, exactly, exactly.
Yeah,
we're a slipper.
It's so lovely.
Yeah.
It's so lovely.
So I think that's what let me get away with it. But I don't know if you would call that a talk show or a tonight show.
I honestly don't know either because there's elements of chat in it, but then there's segments as well. And did you have... So with the Australian TV show, it was kind of like a chat show. So it was chatting to people and getting to know people. Or
and we'd also have, you know, music acts. We'd have comedy acts. And my plan was I wanted to be a chat show where the audience got as much attention as the guests.
Oh, cool, yeah.
So you have a guest on, you chat to them, but then you do a bit of audience research. You knew there was someone fascinating in row three who had a really good story, and you'd follow up and you'd turn that into a segment as well.
Yeah.
And we did a bit of that. I think my favourite was there was someone who was about 19 and his dream in life was to one day recreate the Monty Python fish slapping sketch.
Oh yeah, the dancing.
Yeah, where John Cleese and Michael Palin slap each other with fish. So we took him, we found him, and we took him to a hotel room.
This is a very easy dream to make true, by the way, isn't it? Well, okay,
of course, piece of cake. How could it not go wrong?
Yeah.
So we got him. I don't even
think hotel room.
Took him to a hotel room. I don't think even he knew why he was there. Handed him a pith helmet on the way into the hotel room. He walked in. John Cleese was standing there.
No! Okay, sorry. I was saying, because I was thinking of like the way Ireland would make your dream come true, which is like give you a hotel room and a fish and knock yourself out.
Well, we kind of led to it to make him think that's what was going to happen.
Yeah.
John Cleese was in town touring.
Wow.
So he walked into the room and John Cleese handed him a fish and said, let's begin. And just started gently slapping him around the face with a fish.
That's incredible.
And then at the end of it, presented him with the fish, and he hit John Cleese, who then fell out of shot.
Did he hit him hard? Or?
He actually did. And Cleese loved it. He absolutely loved that he went that hard and did it properly. So little bits like that I loved.
Yeah.
But it was just a bit of a mishmash of a show that I think, in retrospect, if I did it again, I would do it as an audience show rather than... And I do it as a show about the audience with occasional guests.
Right.
As opposed to a show about the guests with occasional audience. Stuff. Yeah.
Because I figure Australia is somewhat similar to Ireland in a way that they have a small population for the size of the country.
Yeah.
Because Australia is so big. And I think Ireland's got a small population. And I feel that from watching Australian media, it feels like Australia feels like it's behind the UK.
Yes.
In some ways, and I think Ireland feels it's behind in the UK in some ways too. I don't know, to be honest with you, I've just been watching a lot of, was it Priscilla, Queen of the Desert? And it reminded me a lot of Ireland, just in the way that we are of our sexualities. And I was like, there's got to be some connection here with Australia and Ireland. But what made you move from, you moved to Ireland for a little while, didn't you?
Yes, I did, yeah.
So how long were you in Ireland and why?
About 2.5 years, I think I was in Ireland.
Oh, it was a big stint.
Yeah. It was all because a friend of mine from Australia had started up a comedy agency over here.
Right.
So she'd come over here.
Is her name Flea?
Flea, yeah.
I've heard of her.
Right.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
So Flea and I used to work together on radio in Adelaide back in the 90s, early 90s.
Okay.
And then there was a big comedy festival in Adelaide, and that's where she met a guy called Eddie Bannon, Irish comedian. They fell in love. She came over here, set up a comedy agency and said, you know, when you come over to do Edinburgh, I'll get you a few gigs. You come to Ireland. And at that point, there was the Laughter Lounge.
Yeah.
There was City Limits in Cork, the GPO in Galway. So there was enough little gigs that you could do.
Yeah, a nice circuit.
Yeah. And so I kind of came for a few months and then I ended up just basing myself here for half the year.
Wow.
And maybe going over to the UK doing Manchester or Liverpool or Newcastle or Edinburgh, wherever I could get a weekend at a club.
Yeah.
But Dublin became home for a good couple of years. And it was such a... It's such a testament to having someone nurturing when it comes to comedy, whether it's a club owner. I was going to say it's all been women, but not... No, there have been a couple of men dotted in there in the past.
Right.
But like the first club I performed at, the Sydney Comedy Store... The time that I was there, there was a woman called Ingrid who was the manager, and she booked the acts. And she wouldn't just book any old act. She booked acts that were good comics, that said the right things on stage, that were good for an audience. And she kind of nurtured us.
Wow.
And Flea did the same thing in Dublin. So in the time that she set up the agency, that's when you had Deirdre O'Kane go through, Dara O'Brien, myself, David O'Doherty, Des Bishop. Like all of these people came out of this one little kind of family, to be fair.
So do you feel like you've got an almost family connection with those comedians?
Oh, absolutely. We used to live together in Edinburgh every year.
Oh, that's so cute. Who's the daddy of the house there?
Oh, wow. Well, there might have been a few fights.
Might have been a few stepdads that were like my...
But, wow. So my first Edinburgh, 97 and 98, I think I produced on my own. And then by 99, I was living in Dublin. and it was the Lisa Richards agency, or I think it was called Acme then. But yeah, we'd all, so a household in Dublin, in Edinburgh, sorry, for the month would be, I think I lived with Dara maybe 2 or 3 years in Edinburgh. David O'Doherty, Deirdre O'Kane, let's see, Patrick McDonald, Joe Rooney.
Whoa.
I think lived with us 1 year.
Yeah.
There were whole groups of us, and we would go, and I would be part of the Best of Irish comedy show.
Really?
So it'd be on like 11 o'clock at night. Whoever had finished their solo shows would then do the Best of Irish with me in the middle. Because I was kind of technically Irish.
Yeah, Irish citizen.
And we did some improv. And in fact, that was the year that we did, there was a group called Boom Chicago.
Okay.
Who are an improv group based
in Holland, aren't they?
Yes. Yeah, in Amsterdam. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they were on before us.
Right.
And then they would hang around and we'd all improvise together.
Wow.
But one of the guys was Seth Meyers.
Wow.
Who now hosts the Late Late Show.
Yeah. Amazing.
So he used to come and then we'd all do improv together in the Best of Irish show.
At the Best of Irish. Yeah. Oh my God. It's, I love talking to comedians just about Edinburgh, I suppose, back in the day, because Edinburgh now is so massive and you feel so inconsequential.
Yeah.
But it's lovely to hear people reminisce like they've had fun, because it just seems like a big, almost like a convention for comedians now,
yeah.
You know? And it's like, I've been chatting to Deirdre about it before and stuff, and like, you know, just how great a time she had. And this is nice to see.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Listen, but, you know. I mean, I've shared houses with Dee during Edinburgh, and I've seen the ups and the downs.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things you look back on and go, what an amazing time it was.
Yeah.
But it's still, you know, in the middle of when we were in Edinburgh, we'd hear comics reminiscing about 10 years beforehand.
What was it like 10 years before? It was a field.
Well, it was. It was, you know, even before the Perrier Award came about, because people weren't going to see comedy. They were going to see theatre and drama and dance and everything else. And so they said, well, why don't we come up with this comedy award?
Mm.
And then maybe it'll get some attention and people will start going to see stand-up comedy.
Yeah,
at the Fringe. And not even stand-up, like Footlights was the first year with Rowan Atkinson and Emma Thompson and all of those guys.
Yeah, that won the award, didn't it, that year?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly, yeah. So even by the time we got there, like Late and Live.
Yeah.
Late and Live, when I started doing Late and Live, was rough as guts.
Yeah, I've heard
it
that.
Was, Ross Noble would compare, like after a few years, after I'd been going 2 or 3 years, Ross would compare, or I would compare, or Daniel Kitson would compare.
Wow.
And there are some nights, there's a lovely photo I found last week of Ross and Daniel and myself all on stage together.
Oh, wow.
Because there are a few nights where we compared the shows together.
Together?
Yeah.
How would that, a tree hander?
Oh, my God. It was nuts. I think it was the last ever night at the Gilded Balloon on Cowgate before they moved venue.
Yeah.
And it was Ross and Daniel and I, and I think, I mean, there was one, I think that was the night where Daniel ended up going on stage with Tommy Tiernan and Sean Hughes, and they called themselves Three Stages of Perrier.
All right.
And, I mean, I was there when Russell Brand had a glass thrown at him.
I think I see that on YouTube.
Yeah.
There's something about blood anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, although that was a fake blood patch. For some reason, he came on with a blood capsule around his stomach and pretended to stab himself. We never quite got to the bottom of that.
No, I don't think we ever will.
But then people would talk about, even like 5 years before that, where Late and Live was really horrific compared to what we were doing. So there's always going to be a good old days. Like in 10 years' time, people are going to look back on the Edinburghs that you
we
do
had, yeah.
And go, oh, man, you guys had it so good.
Do you remember Chortle? Do you remember it? It will be like that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
I mean, I remember being in Montreal a few years back for the festival, and there was a young Australian comedian with us. I can't remember who it was. I think it was Joel Creasy. I might be wrong though. And we'd gone out for coffee after our gig, and then we were on the way back, and we said, oh, we're going to meet up some people and have something to eat. And he went, oh, right, okay. And he said, now, who are the people? Who's this guy here? He was walking ahead of us. And I went, oh, that's Steve Bennett. And he went, oh, my goodness, we're having dinner with Steve Bennett from Chortle?
No way.
And he was panicking. I was like, I've known Steve for years. Like, we all know Steve when he set up the website.
Yeah.
And he was the only person reviewing. So it's kind of, yeah, now there's going to be this, remember when Shorter was the most?
It would, because it seems to be like people go on about their stars, how many stars they get, or they go, I'm not reading reviews this year. Yeah. Don't tell me reviews. But you see the way people act around people, they know what their reviews are, you know?
And at least now,
yeah,
it seems like there are so many different publications.
Yeah.
That there are so many different star systems that it's a bit diluted. But when I started, it was the Scotsman and the List, and that was it.
Yeah.
And if you got 5 stars in the Scotsman, that's it, you sold out the rest of the run.
Right.
And everyone knew that you got 5 stars in the Scotsman. And everyone knew if you got 1 star. And it was an amazing story of a Scottish comedian who his housemate came home on Edinburgh and just found him in the middle of the lounge room just swearing, bastards, pricks. I'm not even going to go with the rest of the words. And his housemate came in and said, what's the matter? And he said, the Scotsman said they were going to print my review today and they haven't, the bastards.
Oh, my, because they
went, hang on, whoa, where are you looking? And he went, I'm looking under the name of my show. And he went, no, you've got to look under your name because they do it alphabetically by surname. I went, right. He left the room and then a minute later heard, bastards!
Oh, I wish he wishes he didn't find it. Yeah. Oh my god!
You know that good weather we've been having lately? Do you know what would be great with that good weather? Some sweet cold Copperberg. Copperberg are great. Thank you very much for sponsoring the show, Copperberg. We're going to be doing some live stuff soon as well. So. Listen out during the next podcasts to get a proper date, and I'll tell you what guests I have, but I'm very excited. So thank you so much to Copperberg, you're very lovely guys. When you're in the pub next week or whenever and you're trying to make a choice about what beverage to drink, go, which beverage can I financially support Alison Spittle with? And that answer is Copperberg. Okay, I hope that helps you with your next drinking decision. To be honest, that's how I do all of my decisions. Which product will financially benefit Alison Spittle? Not many, but Copperberg is one of them.
You know, I think when you're going through, you're not really sure, you don't really know that you're part of a kind of generation, if you want to use that word.
Yeah.
You know, it's just Ross and myself and Daniel and we'd host the shows, and then after us, who was it? Russell, it might have been Russell Howard after us started doing Late Lives, and then and then as we finished up, then kind of Flight of the Conchords came through and David O'Doherty.
Jesus.
So there's always these it's just amazing to live through it all and look back on the people that are now seen as, oh my god, they're comedy gods.
And would you how many Edinburghs, not how many Edinburgh hours have you done, but with your progression through Edinburgh and doing your hours, how has it changed for you? How do you approach doing an hour now? I mean, if you ever do an Edinburgh again, doing an hour, I don't know if, like, at what point people stop.
Well, for me, Edinburgh was always the end game.
Okay. Like,
that was the end of my season. So I would start off with a new show in the Adelaide Fringe in February, and then I'd take it to the Melbourne Comedy Festival in April, and then I'd tour it around a little bit more, come over here, maybe tour around Ireland, get it up to speed. Galway was always the last place I'd play. Then I'd go to Edinburgh, and then I'd do a month in Edinburgh, and then have a month on the couch not doing anything, and then I'd start writing a new show.
Yeah.
And that's what it was for years. But then gradually it became, I'd do Edinburgh, and then maybe the next January I'd go out on tour.
Okay.
Like if I had a good Edinburgh.
With that show.
Yes. Mm. And then it would be, well, actually, why not just do Edinburgh and then go straight out on tour, you know, for the end of the year and maybe the beginning of the next year.
So Edinburgh became the start of the...
It became a midpoint.
Okay, yeah.
And now it's kind of, it's almost the beginning point now for me. So I'll probably do an hour in Edinburgh next year.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'll do Melbourne before that, I'm not sure. But then that hour will then become 70, 80 minutes that I'll take on tour for another year and a half. And instead of it being a 12-month process, it's now like a 3-year process for every show.
Wow. Yeah, because it feels like a very short process, though, to get rid of material. You know, it seems like very... I watch a lot of American comedians and they seem to keep on to material for a long time.
Yeah.
And you watch the British comedians and it's just kind of gone within a year's cycle.
I think there's got to be a middle ground. I think, like, 18 months to 2 years is probably long enough for a show.
Yeah.
And I know that's what kicked Louis C.K.'s career along when he first came to Edinburgh and went, oh, my God, you guys write a new hour every year.
Yeah.
And then he went back to the States and went, I'm going to write a new hour every year. And then everyone went, oh, my God, who's this guy writing a new hour every year?
Who's this maestro?
This is incredible. Everyone in Edinburgh went, dude, we've been doing this forever.
Yeah.
So I think you're right, though. It's such a shame to get to the end of that and then just throw it all out. I mean, having something like a DVD or a CD or a recording where you can have a concrete reminder of what the material was, go there. If anyone wants to hear it, they still can. Helps. It's a weird... My process of writing is just setting myself, like, how many minutes I need to write per week.
Really?
Yeah. I used to go, okay, well, I've got 6 months to write a new show.
Mm-hmm.
That's 10 minutes per month. That's 2.5 minutes per week.
Yeah.
And then I'd go out, if I was doing 3 or 4 gigs a week, then that's literally 30 seconds a gig.
Yeah, it's very incremental. It's like you make material like a stalagmite or something, or a stalactite, just lovely calcified.
It's so much. I found if I set myself that, there might be a week where I only came up with a minute's worth of new stuff.
Yeah.
But then the next week you'd add to that, and then you'd find another way of making that bit funny, and then you'd come up with another story, and then suddenly by the end of the month you go, oh, I've come up with 10 minutes this month.
That's great.
And then, 6 months later you've got a show. Yeah. Also helps if you ad lib a lot, because then you only need to write 45 minutes, not 60.
I'm such I think I'm lazy. I think I've come to the conclusion that I'm lazy.
Oh, yeah.
But before I said to myself, oh, I write on stage. So I would like have a keyword on my hand and then try and ad lib some kind of joke out of it. Which is like, I'm seeing it now as not a very economical good thing for the audience either. You know, if they've paid to see you, you really do need the gold, you know?
I think if you're gonna go on stage and ad lib around a word on your hand, it probably has to be sold as a work in progress.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
And there's what's lovely, I don't know about here, but in London at the moment there are plenty of new material nights.
Really?
Where newer comics, but also relatively established comics, can walk up on stage. The audience know what they're in for.
Yeah.
You walk up on stage. Everyone walks up on stage with two things, a notepad. And their phone. And they put their phone down, hit record.
Yeah.
And then just go through notes and do stuff. And the audience know. So there might be a night where it's Ed Byrne, Rich Hall, Glenn Wall, Tiff Stevenson, Lou Sanders.
Yeah.
And I say that there might be a night. I've seen that night. And then I've been on as well. And everyone's got notes, or we're just trying stuff out. And the audience get to see really top acts,
right?
Do some jokes that do work and don't work.
It is great to see a comedian that's had it a long time work their stuff out. I saw like David had already do a work in progress, a very early work in progress of his new show.
Yeah,
and because I just put him on a pedestal and think he's incredible, and I was like, I see what you're doing. I see you.
Well, there's a great thing Chris Rock said that. You know, in the advent of mobile phones now, he's really scared to try new material. Because you know when you try new material, it's not right.
Yeah, and sometimes you can step over the line of not even what's not funny or what's... Sometimes the first thing that comes to your head is not necessarily the nicest thing.
Yeah. You know? Well, he was talking about one of his routines where he said, you know, for the first 6 months of me doing that, it was borderline offensive. And some nights... over the border, it was just offensive.
Yeah.
And it took me 6 months to work out how to do it the right way. So if there was someone in the crowd filming that and then putting it on YouTube, that whole routine's dead straight away. Yeah.
Yeah, because you turn your... I'm guilty of this too as a watcher. If someone starts off with a harsh sentence to make a point that they're going to probably turn around and, and be nice about it in the end, in my head I'm like, no, I don't want to listen now. Don't listen to you. I'm terrible.
Yeah.
I'm terrible for that. And I feel weird about that as an audience. As a comedian, I feel that people are thinking that too. Like if I said something, I tried to do something, and I'll probably bleep this out. I tried to do something about cocaine yesterday.
Yeah.
Because I did it once and I was trying to do a funny story about it. But I think people were just worried for me that I took cocaine and they didn't laugh.
Oh, really? Right.
Yeah, I was trying to talk about how apparently when you take cocaine, I've been told by people that they become pricks. They become like...
Right.
But I just had normal self-esteem for a person, which was... I was trying to put it across there, but I think I put myself too low status for them to laugh. I definitely said something. I'm sorry that I'm coming to you asking you for
No, maybe it needs, no, no, I love this stuff. This is great. Maybe, yeah, because it's not, sorry, I'm really thinking this through, because it's not just about being a prick, is it? It's about being overconfident, because it gives you an enormous amount of confidence.
Yes, yeah.
So there is something in, maybe it's instead of saying that you did become a prick, maybe it's, I reckon if I took it, I would probably have a normal self.
Oh, that's a good idea. And then I don't have to admit that I've done that.
Well, especially if you haven't.
Yeah.
You know, the audience can always smell when you're kind of lying as
well. That's very true. That's a good point.
But then,
let's say I haven't, audience.
Or you have, like, either way. But there's also that thing, though, that a lot of people, I think, I'm overly analysing your joke now.
Yeah, no,
but I think a lot of people do take cocaine because they've got like confidence problems.
I literally took the cocaine because there was someone in the room I was uncomfortable with and I needed to step away from them. That's the only reason I did it.
Right.
Was literally because it was in the corner of a room away from that person. That's literally why I did it.
That's a great story.
I was just like, oh, look, cocaine. I must go explore this.
I mean, that is a damning indictment on someone else's personality.
Isn't it? That I would rather.
You are willing to try a class A drug for the first time.
Yeah.
Just to get away from
them. Exactly. To get out of their personal space. That is a risk. I might die. I don't care.
I mean, that story in itself should be told on stage.
You're so I'm going to do it. Not tonight. At the Tree Arena, I think I'll just do an old joke.
Oh, I tell you what. I haven't done stand-up. The last stand-up gig I did was a charity gig.
Okay.
And I was the last act on. And I was not even in my own defense. I was really tired. I'd been doing a lot of gigs.
Yeah.
And we were all talking backstage. John Richardson was on the bill. He was hosting the bill. And backstage doing that thing of going, right, do I do old material or new material?
Yeah.
And thinking, it's a charity. I've been doing a lot of charity gigs lately where I'm doing 20 minutes and it's great because you can try out new stuff.
20 minutes is a great time set anyway. You can really play around and get out.
Exactly.
You know, you're
this,
not.
This one was 10 minutes at the end of the night.
Yeah.
Everyone was tired. Everyone had been great.
Yeah.
And I was walking around backstage going, new or old. And we're all looking at each other. And I think my tired head with my little bit of an ego went, I'm going to do new. By the time I walked off stage, I went, I should have done old.
I know. That's annoying. Were they laughed out, do you think? Or were they just... No, it wasn't old.
Okay. They were good. But it wasn't a killer set.
Yeah.
And what also made it tricky was certain charity audiences, like there are a lot of charity gigs that happen at the Comedy Store and it'll be for, you know, MS or it'll be for the Children's Trust Hospital.
Yeah.
But it'll go to won't go to the Comedy Store mailing list. It'll go to the Children's Trust mailing list.
So the Children's Trust audience rather than a Comedy Store audience.
Exactly. So it's not an audience that necessarily see a lot of stand-up comedy. So they're slightly different. You've got to pitch it ever so slightly differently.
Yeah.
And I think this particular night in oh, go on, let's analyse it. So it was Brighton.
Okay.
And I've got a whole bit about transgender.
Okay.
And the whole, it starts with the line of, you know, I'm going to say something really offensive when I'm 70 and I'm not going to know what it is.
So bear
with me. You know, I just apologise now. I know my kids are going to be going, Dad, you can't say that. And I'll be going, what? In my day, we called them men and women. That's the starting off line.
Yeah.
And then it's a really tricky one to navigate because it is about me saying, all for people who are transitioning, transgender, great, love it, fantastic. Please, I'm just trying to keep up. Please don't hate me if I get it wrong because I'm desperately trying to get it right.
Yeah.
And this particular night, a little bit of tiredness,
end
of the gig, new material, charity audience. I could feel the tone wasn't quite right. And someone, I was kind of saying, look, I don't know what the rules are and I'm still trying to work out what the rules are.
Yeah.
And someone yelled out, just be respectful. And I was like, what?
Oh, thank you. I didn't. You're right. Yeah.
Thank you. I get that. I'm really not. And in my head, I'm going, you're not explaining yourself particularly well.
I know.
And you're tired. Yeah. And come on, get through this. And you should have gone with old material that you know is going to just appeal to everyone.
Yeah.
And then I had this remarkable thing afterwards where someone came to the stage door and said, look, I really like your comedy, but I've got a child who's transgender, and you know, I just want to say what you said looked like it was coming across from a position of cis privilege.
Right.
And I went, right. And I literally said, okay, thanks for that, and I'll go away and work on it. And I had to get in the car with the other comics and go, I don't know what cis privilege means. Can you please explain that to me?
Oh, my gosh.
So, I mean, long story short, that's the last time I did a stand-up gig.
Right, that's the last time.
You can guarantee I'm doing old material tonight.
Yeah. Wow. And that's that type of thing you do have to think about a lot, and you see these... The only comedians that seem to go for it are like the ones that are either really brave or at ages, you know, just about transgender or race or anything.
Yeah, and I've never had any complaints any time I've done it in the past. Yeah. I've always felt as I've said it, I'm saying this the right way.
This particular
night with a little bit of tiredness at the end of the night and it not coming out right. And you know, in your head you're going, oh, I'm not saying this right. That's all well and good when you're doing a joke about 80s music.
Yeah.
But when you're talking about something that's tricky, like, you know, Islamophobia or transgender issues, if you're not quite getting every word in the right spot,
yeah,
it can come across the wrong way.
And it's the one thing I fear is like always upsetting one person in the audience.
Of course.
Like that person that came up to you that says, I have a child, and it's like, you know, it's a bit of a...
And this person was so lovely about it. That's what
was nice. Of course. And it's nice that they came up to you and told you that. Because I think a lot of people don't get told and then they just get angry.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you know, there's a big kickback with Brexit and stuff. My dad is British and he voted Brexit. And people don't like you joking about them. It's weird. You can't patronize them either because sometimes they feel patronized, and it's a hard time to communicate at the moment. Generally, I should ask you about the last leg. How are we doing for time? Actually,
it's about 5 minutes.
5 minutes.
Just turning 7
now. Awesome. Okay. Awesome. Thank you. This has been great, by the way.
I'm really enjoying this.
I'm really enjoying it too.
Did we start properly though? How did it?
We did. No, it's cool. I'm actually not that frazzled from the microphone situation. You've been lovely. It's been
good.
It couldn't have been a nicer person that I've mildly inconvenienced.
Oh, do you know?
So thank you.
Do you know what? That just made me think of. I feel like I've paid it forward then, because many years ago in Montreal, I was thinking about this the other day. I turned up late for the gala. They had the big gala in Montreal where you do your spot. Have you been to Montreal?
I've never been, but I'd love to go. Like, that would be the next one I'd like to do.
Yeah,
you know?
And they televise it and they have a massive celebrity host the gala. And I think I've done it with Nathan Lane and one with the Muppets hosting.
The Muppets?
Yeah.
I'm starstruck by that. Sorry.
Oh, really? Okay, I'll get to the Muppets. That's incredible. But this particular one, I had been booked to do another spot across town earlier.
Yeah.
And it was running late. We got stuck in traffic and I turned up late for the gala. And it's the biggest thing, it's the big thing that you do in Montreal.
Yeah.
And I'm running in panting going, I can't believe it. The show's already started. And I'm frazzled like you were. And as I got to my dressing room, Martin Short is standing out the front of my dressing room, who I had met at a previous festival. And he goes, hey, Adam, how are you? I went, oh, my God. Oh, what's the matter? I went, oh, I just had this thing and it was across town and now I'm running late. It's the one big thing that I want to do is the gala. And he just reached down and put his hand on my shoulder and he went, Adam, there's no need to worry. I know you're going to kill it. And I was like, it's like a little comedy Buddha.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
He talked to me for 5 minutes. I remember Richard Cook, actually, who's the Irish manager.
Yeah.
I remember him going to walk into my dressing room to see how I was and stopping mid-step as he saw me talking to Martin Short and then just slowly backed out.
Good for him. Good for him that he knew that there's nothing he could add to this conversation.
No. So, the Muppets were...
Wow.
The Muppets is... I've told this story on stage, but it was such a huge comedy lesson for me because I knew the Muppets were going to be hosting a gala.
Yeah.
But I didn't know which one I was going to be on. And you have to submit your material.
Okay.
And I had 5 minutes on The Swedish Chef.
Wow.
So I just said, well, this is the material I want to do this year, hoping they would go, oh, well, he needs to be on the Muppets gala. And they did. But there were a couple of jokes that I was doing before I got onto the Swedish Chef material. One of which they said, look, that's a little bit harsh for the Muppets.
Were you going to wear the Swedish chef like a slipper or something like this?
I mean, technically, that is what happens to the Swedish chef.
Yeah, exactly.
Just with a different limb.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, no, it was weird. It had nothing to do with the Swedish chef. But I got on this thing in my head of going, no, this is my joke. I like this joke. And I want to do this joke. And I really was tossing up whether or not to do it. And I kind of tweeted about it and said, what should I do? And one of the people that tweeted back was Dara O'Brien, who said, comedy is truth, but it's also a great way to meet Kermit the fucking Frog.
Amazing.
And then Brendan Byrne said the same thing. And he went, mate, touch the frog. I went, what do you mean touch the frog? And he went, are you going to get to high five Kermit? And I went, probably. And he went, then touch the frog. Do your joke somewhere else, you dickhead. And I still turned up that night thinking, no, I'm going to do my joke. I'm not going to be told. And I walked in.
You were going to rebel against the Muppets.
I was going to rebel against the Muppets. But they were doing two shows that night. And as I walked in, they were finishing the first show by singing The Rainbow Connection. And as soon as I heard that, I went, just drop the joke, Adam.
Good for you.
It's not about you. It's The Rainbow Connection. It's about putting love into a room, you idiot.
Yeah, exactly. I do love it, though, that you were very conflicted about, totally. You know, the Muppets are trying to dull my truth. They're trying to...
Of all the people.
Yeah, I know.
I'm not gonna do what the man tells the frog.
The frog, yeah.
And so I then ended up going out on stage, not doing the joke, doing all my Muppets material.
Yeah.
But the lovely moment was that the Swedish chef was the act on before me.
Okay.
So they purposely put me on after him. And he'd done that thing where he throws his spoons into the air. And one of them fell on the stage and no one picked it up.
Yeah.
So when I walked out on stage, I picked it up, put it in my pocket.
Yeah.
And went, oh, I'm keeping that. It's a Swedish chef spoon. And then did my whole set about the Swedish chef.
Yeah.
Got to the end. Mind you, I'd been introduced on stage by Kermit. I have to point out, got to the end, when I went to walk off stage, the Swedish chef walked out, reached into my pocket, pulled out the spoon, smacked me with it, and then went, oh, okay, and gave it back to me.
Oh, good. I genuinely thought he was going to keep it.
No, he was so... And then signed it for me backstage.
Oh, wow.
Apparently, I didn't know this, but as I left the stage, I didn't hear it. Kermit said, hey, that guy was great. We should rough him up and turn him into a Muppet. But then when I walked off, there's all these guys in black T-shirts and jeans standing and applauding. And I thought they must have been the tech crew.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, that's really nice. I don't know why the tech crew would be applauding, but that's nice.
Yeah.
And then they started talking with them with... They were the puppeteers.
Were they? Did they have like... I wonder, did they get repetitive strain injury in their hands?
Yeah, they do.
They must do. Yeah. They must look like tennis players or something, just constant kind
we
of...
We had Miss Piggy and Kermit on the last leg recently.
Oh, wow.
And they asked if... They had little monitors so that when the camera was off them, they could just have a bit of a rest.
Yeah,
The handlers needed a rest.
Yeah.
Kermit and Piggy were fine,
yeah,
but the handlers needed a rest because they don't have puppeteers. They have handlers.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, because they're not puppets.
Because they're real.
Yeah, they're real, of course.
But the great bit was, so the one of the guys, one of the handlers said, oh, my God, did you just ad-lib that whole set?
To you doing your...
Yeah.
Oh, right.
And
yeah.
I went, no, I'm really... I have to admit, that was actually a routine. And he went, oh, my God, you have a five-minute bit about the Swedish chef. Yeah, I'm pretty sure every comedian's got stuff about the Muppets.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they were amazing. And then we went back to the bar, and they kind of recognised me at the bar and said, come and drink with us.
Wow.
So I ended up sitting, swapping stories with all the Muppets handlers, a couple of them who had been there since day one.
Wow.
The guy who handles Gonzo, the great Gonzo, had been there since day one.
Oh,
so we were
gosh.
All swapping stories. And then when they came to London to film Muppets Most Wanted, they invited me down to the set.
Adam!
And there is actually a scene on a train where Walter and Fozzie are on a train and I'm crouched down at their feet just hanging out with them all.
That's amazing.
It was the best thing ever.
That it's hard enough to be friendly with human heroes, but like Muppet heroes.
Well, the best
it's incredible.
The best thing was with the Muppet heroes. So we're all crouched down
with
the handlers, and Fozzie and Walter are doing a scene above us. But then between scenes, they would start talking to me. In particular, Fozzie would start talking to me.
In Fozzie's voice?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So Fozzie was like, hey, Adam. And I went, yeah, anyway, how do you think I should do this scene? Should I walk like this? And then he'd do a little walk. Or should I walk like this? And then he'd do another little walk. And I was
like, oh, my gosh.
I mean, this is ideal. I was chatting here with Fozzie between takes
That's
on a Muppets movie.
Oh, my God.
Pretty much, highlight of career.
That is highlight. That's amazing. And now we're doing the Tree Arena.
Woohoo! Yeah, Tree Arena is also...
Yeah, I'm so excited about it. Yeah. You know what you're doing, your old bit today? Like, do you have a bit you have?
I think I know what I'm doing.
I think I know what I'm doing as well, but it depends on what the other people do before me. I want to have a watch and see.
Yeah.
Don't want to do anything too similar. I have a bit that's similar to another person's bit that I didn't mind because I've figured that person would be going on after me and I'll just do my bit and let them worry about it, but they're going on before me.
Okay.
So I've got two bits.
Yeah.
It's not even that similar. It's just the mechanics of it that's similar.
Right.
That I've often done it before and the audience haven't laughed as hard as it because they've kind of heard the mechanic of it in a previous joke that night.
I think you've got, especially on a bill like this, you've got to keep an eye on everyone else.
Yeah.
And it's hard because there's so many different acts.
I mean, they're just starting right now. Can you hear that?
Yeah. Did you have that pang of, oh my God?
I really did. Look, thank you so much, Adam, for agreeing to do the podcast. And thanks so much for this. It's been great fun. It really has.
I can't believe that this has been recorded.
Yeah.
It feels like I've just had the best chat ever.
Oh, brilliant. Oh, thank you.
Oh, that was great.
Thank you.
That was really good fun.
Okay, guys. Thank you so much to Adam Hills, who was so lovely and took a lot of time out of his day to do the podcast. Thanks so much to Jane Russell and George O'Kane and Darren Smith, who organised the Comic Relief gig. I think it's going to be on everywhere. It should be on every year. It's a great event. It's very good for raising money for charity and there's so many funny people on the night. Also, thank you so much to Sarah Garvey, the engine behind the Alison Spittle Show. She was there at the Tree Arena and to be honest with you, if it was her, she wouldn't forget the microphones. That's how great she is. Thank you so much to Bobby Ahern from No Monster Club who did the music. Bobby Ahern got mentioned on My Favourite Murder in Vicar Street in Dublin. I went on the second day, had a great time. But you should check out Bobby Ahern's videos. He did this video on a murderer in Dublin, and also he's got this great book out called Do You Remember Your Man? He doesn't just do music and you should check that stuff out. I did a podcast with him a few podcasts ago and he's really interesting and you should check out that episode too. Thank you very much to William Conway. I haven't done any episodes with William Conway because he's my old school friend. He works in animation up in Belfast and I hope he's having a great time up there. He's a really good guy. So thank you very much for the artwork that you did on the logo, William. I really love it and appreciate it. God, they sound very personal, don't they? The credits this week. I don't know. Just telling you a bit about the people. And thanks very much to Alan Bennett, who is the head of Head Stuff. He's not the... he's not the writer, Alan Bennett. He's an Irish man who is absolutely working so hard on the Head Stuff Podcast Network. And he does a really good job. And Paddy as well. He does a great job too. Right, I'm done with the thank yous. Biggest thank you goes to Copperberg this week for sponsoring the show. Thank you very much. They're going to sponsor a few more shows. And it's great when you get a sponsor because I love making this podcast so much. I really do. But it's just handy to get paid for something that you love. Like, that's my aim in life. And also, like, you know, other people need to get paid as well because other people work hard. And Copperberg are facilitating that. So thank you very much. And... yeah, that's all my thank yous done. I'm going to tell you about a few gigs that are coming up. I did The Guilty Feminist in Norwich, and it's an episode about Repeal the 8th.
and you can listen to that at The Guilty Feminist. I was going to say it's a great podcast, as if you haven't heard of The Guilty Feminist and you're just listening to mine, which would be a very, very, very tiny wedge of people. But you should listen to it. It's one of the biggest podcasts in the world, and I'm very lucky to be on it sometimes. And we were talking about Repeal the Eighth with Helen Linehan, and I only got emotional once, so I was quite happy with myself. But yeah, I'm gonna go canvassing today to Repeal the Eighth, and I'm very scared. Lovely girl called Rachel has given me a lift out to Selbridge, and we're gonna try canvassing because I'm just not sure what to do. Do you know, I'm just a bit afraid. I'm a bit human, you guys, and and I wanna give canvassing a go, but I am very scared of canvassing because I don't know, like, it's like my friend Deborah, actually I have a friend that was a Jehovah's Witness, so I'm genuinely actually going to text her and ask her for advice about knocking on doors and see how that goes down. Yeah, the referendum, well, look, registration is done. If you're registered, please go vote on the 25th of May. My nerves are killing me at the moment with it. I need to go canvassing. I'm going to tell you about some gigs now. I always talk about gigs at the end, and everybody who, I mean, look, I hop off a podcast as soon as somebody goes, thank you very much, I'm gone. I'm like, nah, mate. Unless I really, 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 really like you. You know, like Adam Buxton, I'll listen to, because I just want to hear what happens to his dog and stuff. So, yeah. And I used to have a hashtag called #apricotparty, if you're still listening now. So if you're still listening now, #apricotparty. Yeah, so what I'm doing gig-wise at the moment is Kilkenny Cat Laughs. I'm doing a whole weekend there. I'm doing the Reductress podcast. I'm doing the Reductress comedy night. There's, I think they're on a Monday and a Sunday. I'm doing Dream Gun film reads, which is like a, oh, it's so funny, guys. It's where like these four talented writers rewrite a film script to make it even funnier. And we're doing Back to the Future. I've never seen Back to the Future before, so that's my shame. But they're doing Back to the Future, and they're getting me in to play a few characters and read out the script. And it's really, really funny. And then I'm doing comedy. I'm doing a gig with Rory Scovel and Maeve Higgins, and I'm so excited about that. I'm doing a gig with Reginald D. Hunter, and I'm really excited about that. And Deirdre O'Kane. And I'm doing the opening gala. So, yeah, I'm super, super psyched to be at Kilkenny. And that's going to be fun. Also, I'm doing some previews of Warrior Princess. So I'm going to be doing a gig in Newcastle. Yeah, so if you live in Newcastle or you know anyone that lives in Newcastle, I have sold no tickets for Newcastle because I haven't tried yet, but I've got my tickets booked and I'm a bit anxious about that. So if you know anybody in Newcastle, it's where I got my tattoo, so I feel a lot of, I was very drunk when I got it, but I feel a lot of attachment. So yeah, my gig is on the 17th of June in Newcastle, and it's on during the day. So, and the 24th of June, I'm doing a daytime gig in the Stand Comedy Club in Glasgow. So that should be grand. So the 24th and the 17th, I'm doing previews over in the UK. 17th is in Newcastle, 24th is in Glasgow. And also I'm going to be doing some previews in Smock Alley in July. So I'm trying to redo the show Warrior Princess to bring it over to Edinburgh. And I'm getting rid of all the very localised stuff. If you've seen Warrior Princess, Well, if you've seen Warrior Princess, like last year, it was all about me talking about underage discos and stuff, and it was super local. And then I brought it out on tour, and I got rid of that bit, and I brought in a few other bits. But I'm just rejigging the ship at the moment, and I'm taking out a big chunk of it and replacing it with some other stuff that I've written while I was on tour. I think that's what me and Adam chat about. I think I want to do more bits about feelings or whatever. Guys, I'm going to get off now and stop talking. I'm done.
This podcast is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.